Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 15th of January. Our guest this hour is the founder of the White House Project. Marie Wilson is with us. Marie has been an advocate of women's issues for more than 30 years. She is co-creator of the Take Our Daughters and Sons to Work Day, also author of Closing the Leadership Gap, Why Women Can and Must Help Run the World. In 1998, Marie founded the White House Project in recognition of the need to build a truly representative democracy, one in which women lead alongside men in all spheres. For nearly two decades, she was president of the Ms. Foundation for Women. She is an honorary founding mother of the Ms. Foundation, was the first woman elected to the Des Moines City Council as a member at large in 1983, and also served as an official government delegate to the UN Fourth World Conference on Women that was held in Beijing in 1995. She says, despite the common view that women already permeate every level of leadership in this country ranks 67th in the world in terms of female political representation, and women lead only 13 Fortune 500 companies. We'll be welcoming phone calls from Marie, as we always do. And our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. We also have this email that you can use, and that's talk@wpr.org. Hi, Marie.
Hi, good to hear your voice this morning.
Yeah, nice to have you with us. Tell me about the motivation for founding this White House Project in 1998. What did you see that really bothered you?
Well, what I saw that really bothered me was that women were not leading in sufficient numbers across any sector of American society. And having spent 20 years as the president of the Ms. Foundation for Women and looking at the very creative kind of programs that women were running around the country, almost like the government in exile in almost every area, in health and safety and in the economy, I felt like we ought to get them into power so they didn't have to keep, you know, being the government in exile or beating on the doors of the legislature to get the things done that they knew how to do.
You cite statistics showing, and these numbers are really low, that women hold just 16.3% of 535 seats in Congress. That's really low, isn't it?
You know, it's interesting because it's really low, and it's beyond the imagination of people who just are sure that women have been making steady progress mm-hmm. and who want to think that we are really and truly a representative democracy, and we're not. Wisconsin is just not too great either. You have about 22% of the state legislature being women, and it's surprising how slow this has moved in the last decade.
Why?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One is that we install term limits, if you recall, in the legislative system, and that's the pipeline. The state legislature and those executive offices are the pipeline, right, to the higher offices. And when we did the term limits, I think that there was a kind of hope, shall we say, or really a thought, that when people were term limited out, when enough men were term limited out, they would be replaced by women. It did not work that way. And I think that was one failure. And the second thing is we didn't have the political will to kind of keep up that whole bringing people into the system that we had in the late 60s and the 70s and the 80s, where we started to really recruit women through the national organizations. Mm-hmm. So we've had to rebuild a kind of new women's political movement in the last several years, but it is happening. And that's part of why we're in Wisconsin bringing women into the system, because we have to really be intentional now to build that pipeline.
What kind of outreach are you doing, and I know you're doing this, to young women to get them to run for office?
Well, our outreach is really a very is characterized by something quite different. We feel that we are building a path for women to really take leadership and transform, you know, what we need here, which is a really representative and a participating democracy. And so we are doing broad outreach around the country. We're in about 12 states. We have field offices in 5 states. And we are getting women to come. It's very different. We're getting them to come to the trainings that we do, which are debate boot camps and full go-run trainings. But when they come to these trainings, what we're saying is come if you want to run in the next 10 years, so you don't scare people away, because most trainings are like, you want to run for office or assuming you're going to run the next year. We find you get a really broad diversity of people if you don't tell them they got to run right then. And what happens? The same percentage of them decide to run, but they aren't thinking that they have to. We call this, we inform, we inspire, and we equip. And if you don't run, you become a part of something that helps other women run. So you're really not just getting people to run, you're building the effort and joining women to it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think part of the problem here, and this has been brought up often, Marie, but that women still, all studies show, shoulder a great deal of the household burden. They do the cleaning, they still really are taking care of the children in a much larger way than men are. It's changing, but it's very slow. And it's hard to do both. It's hard to have a really full political life, campaigning and raising money and getting reelected and being on the road and take care of the house.
Well, I completely get it. I always tell people I had 5 children under yeah. 6 at one time, and nothing has ever really looked hard to me since then. But that's exactly right. Women are still shouldering the majority of that load, and even though men are increasingly younger men participating. But you're so right, as indicated by the fact that when we do the trainings, part of what we do is what we learn through our research about how you get young women, and really it applies to so many women, to take this step. And they said, you have to show me that it makes a difference. So we bring in panels of people who are in political office at every level and have them give the message. And the first thing the women want to know that are in their, 20s and 30s, and often early 40s, as they stand up and say, can you have a family and mm-hmm. do this job? And you have a variety of women who talk to them about how they manage that. That's really important to me, because I think if we don't get a critical mass, a diverse and critical mass of women into these political positions, we won't change the conditions under which people can raise children, and that's part of the problem.
Right. You talk in your writings about a deeply ingrained political and cultural factor or factors that still support the resistance to women at the top. What are those political and cultural factors?
Well, are we seeing them right now?
Here we go.
No, are we seeing those political and cultural factors
yeah,
in front
sure
of our eyes or at large?
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Some of the cultural factors have to do with just starting at the big mega factor, which is that gender roles are changing in this country and in the world slowly, but they are changing. And as those roles change, there is a fear of women moving into power. And so what you're seeing is an increased kind of misogyny out there about women. I mean, that's what's come up around this election, the finding of all these misogynist kind of websites and discrimination. The second thing, though, that's happening that is keeping women out of power, at the very top, has to do with, again, not understanding that we have to keep putting numbers in there if we want women to get in and be able to be themselves. We've always tried to throw one woman up at a time, so part of it is we're needing to all of us understand the systemic factors and putting numbers in. And the other thing is we aren't willing to do what other countries have done that really have changed it. The countries that have been able, the many, many countries, right, who are ahead of us, the 69 or 70 other countries that are ahead of us in terms of the percentage of women in the state legislature, say, or in Congress, is that they know it doesn't happen naturally, that they've installed quotas. And, our country will never do that. But what it takes is the political will to do something that really says we hold you accountable if you are not going to be a representative democracy. It works differently in different countries, but it either says you have to have women among the candidates in a percentage, or you have to have so many of the women that are elected to office a percentage, and that has changed everything in the countries that have it. And the top country in the world now is Rwanda, which happened not by quotas, but by losing the men. Mm. But the women have really made enormous successful changes in Rwanda.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you had a chance to see Bob Herbert's column today.
Oh,
but
yes.
It's really a knockout column. And part of it is that you don't see columnists writing about misogyny very often, do you? And he writes that it permeates nearly every aspect of American life. For many men, it's the true national pastime, much higher than baseball or football. What a statement.
Well, Bob, I know Bob Herbert, and I've talked to him for years. I've talked to him a great deal about men, as a matter of fact, and men's roles. And he's really a sympathetic and thoughtful man. But I have never seen him write a column like this. I've already emailed him this morning.
Have you?
To say this was important. And why it was important is when we're having a conversation in America over the bodies of two of the best candidates in the world, you know, about race and gender, it is wonderful to have an African-American male journalist who took on the issue of the enormous amount of gender bias and sexism that has come up. And not everywhere. I want to be clear. I don't want every man and woman listening thinking, right, you know, everybody's a part of this. But there is a part of our society and the societies around the world that Francis Fukuyama actually predicted that we would have women coming into power. By the way, when we started the White House Project, the social scientist Francis Fukuyama said, women are coming into power in the next decade when you have men, and particularly men in the poorest countries in the world, but men in our country too, who are not feeling powerful and like their life is going to be the same. And where that misogyny and fear goes is to women.
Interesting. It is remarkable when you think about it, Marie, and I've been very upset about what's been happening the past few days when it comes to discussions of sex and race and the way the Democrats are handling this. But when you think about it, here we are, and we have a woman running for president. We have an African-American president, and chances are pretty good that one of them will be the president. It is a pretty big thing.
Well, what is being missed in this election is the history that's being made in the election,
right?
Because you don't have just your first real contender, you know, as a woman. We've had other women run, but this is your real contender, the first African-American man who's your real contender. Mm-hmm. You have race and gender, but you also have the issue of class, the three things that go together in our country to really make change, which is class, race, and gender. And, you know, you really have a man in John Edwards who, while he is a professional lawyer with resources now, really grew up poor and
yes.
Championing the issue of where he came from.
Yes.
So we're not taking the time and don't have the way to say what an amazing thing that a major party has this kind of bench and this kind of opportunity to talk to America about what we could do if we united around those issues that have held people back in every race.
As you know, Gloria Steinem wrote a much-quoted piece for the New York Times January 8. She talks about and asks this question, and let me ask you if you ask this question as well, why is the sex barrier not taken as seriously as the racial one? Do you think that's true?
Well, I do think it's true. I wrote a small piece a couple of days before Gloria did that at the bottom said what I've been saying all along, and that is I think both of these candidates all are terrific, but I don't think if Obama, of course, happened to be a woman, because I've seen it happen. I've seen it happen with Marcy Kaptur in Ohio when she just even looked like she was going to run, a congresswoman with an enormous track record who got made fun of, you know, terribly by the political press when she showed up in New Hampshire and Iowa. Who does she think she is? And it's a laughing stock. And she had a lot more legislative experience than, of course, Obama did. But with all credit to him, it wouldn't have happened if it was a woman. And we don't take gender as seriously for a lot of reasons. One is gender crosses all races and classes, right? And so women are a part of that, and they live with men. Who are, and they are mothers. I mean, I think what Gloria talks about is just right. Men grew up with the most powerful person in their life being a mother, and I think powerful women are still, again, because of the time we're in, are still scary to men. But the other thing is really that our culture has not changed, and that the cultural ideal of women is wife and mother. And we don't take that kind of thing that you brought up earlier is a reason women are often counted out of leadership.
Mm-hmm.
It is, because the cultural ideal is wife and mother. We don't change the systems that allow women to be in leadership, and then we don't get women into those positions. It's just not normal. We have to get lots of women in and really make it normal. But gender, because it is what Gloria said later in the piece, it seems like it's natural for women to be in oppressive roles, and the misogyny that has to do with the kind of hatred that gets out there when women start to move out of that role, I think comes out of just an enormous amount of fear about who am I as a man if I'm not the kind of manly man that has a woman who I'm over.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our lines are already pretty busy. One is open. If you'd like to take it right now, you could get it. Marie Wilson, founder of the White House Project, is our guest. It was founded in 1998 in recognition of what they saw was a need to build a truly representative democracy, one in which women lead alongside men in all spheres. Our guest was also, well, she's been working with women's issues for more than 30 years. She is co-creator of Take Our Daughters and Sons to Work Day, also author of Closing the Leadership Gap, Why Women Can and Must Help Run the World. She cites the United States ranking 67th in the world in terms of female political representation, and also women leading only 13 Fortune 500 companies. We can get to why that is the case, and welcome your phone calls. So grab the last line. Did I give you the number? 800-486-8655, 227-2050. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we'll be looking at U.S. food safety. In a little less than a year and a half, the number of tainted foods is very, very long. We'll look at why that's the case and how food is inspected and who has jurisdiction and why there aren't more inspectors, and all of that is coming up the second hour of our program today. Marie Wilson, president and founder of the White House Project, author of Closing the Leadership Gap, Why Women Can and Must Help Run the World, is our guest. And we start our calls with Juliet from Rice Lake. Hi, Juliet.
Hi, Kathleen. I just wanted to kind of ask a question regarding women and their work at home, kind of. I wanted to know if the guest had found that women tend to be more involved on the local level, because in my observation, it seems that women who want to help prefer to do so close to home so that they can do both, which is volunteer and parent and other things equally as well, and then they're not giving up one to do the other, and that's kind of where women start and end up being happy because they get a little more gratification maybe out of being able to see the changes that they're making.
That's a very astute, comment, because women are often, when they come to our trainings, beginning at the school board or the city council level, for instance, because that's where they feel like they can have an impact on their children. Some of them start right at the state legislature. I started at the state legislature when I ran, when I ran, because I was very interested in child care. Again, having five children under six, I learned a lot
about
the need for child care. So I really felt that we needed to deal with the quality of child care and the availability of it, and ran for the city council. And a lot of what happens, though, is because women are passionately motivated and you have to be to run for office, where they start is usually at the place or the intersection where they see the problem that they're dealing with, to be honest with you. So you're right in that whatever motivates you to, you know, get done and feel gratified by what you do is the place you enter.
I can't imagine having five children under the age of six, Marie. I just can't imagine that. That's hard work, isn't it?
Yeah, it does make everything look simple, but it's nice now. They're grown and they're really lovely, and now I have little grandchildren under six, so it works fine.
Yeah, and I don't know how many girls you had and boys, but do you have anybody in politics?
All my kids are enormously political, and I have a son who will probably someday run for office, but my three oldest children are enormously political, but have not chosen to serve yet in that way.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Juliet, very much for your call. Let's go next to Orion. Is it from Milwaukee? Hello.
Yes, I'd like to agree with the guest on certain points, especially regarding to NASA and JPL and the space program. The recent fall shuttle mission was commanded by Aileen Collins, a mother in space, and the commander on the space station was an American female astronaut. I'm pretty Republican, but I'm a huge space buff, and we need women astronauts if we're going to colonize the moon and Mars. We have global warming, ozone depletion, all sorts of crazy religious fanatic wars and terrorism. We have to get off this planet.
Okay, what about women in space programs? They do seem to be represented in not huge numbers, but they're way up at the top when it comes to commanding spaceships, et cetera.
Well, what's really interesting about getting women into these programs is it is an enormously good preparation for higher office. We've often included women who are astronauts actually in our work because and tried to recruit them to run for Senate, you know, or to run for Congress because they by the time they have had that kind of training, they know enormous amounts about technology. It's useful about security that's useful, and they feel completely confident about their information. So it's a wonderful training program, actually, for politics.
Mm-hmm. But there aren't any women who have gone from space to politics, are there?
Maybe no, but I'm still trying.
You're on the case, huh, Marie?
I'm on the case.
You're on the case. Thanks, Ryan, very much for your call. Let's go to Dan from White Lake next. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. First of all, I'm wondering. First, I am very much in favor of this notion. And number one, there's no way women can do any worse than the guys have done so far. Number two, no woman is going to carelessly send her children to war like these bozos have done. Number three, I wonder if the social studies programs in our high schools and junior highs ought to be slanted toward getting more people of both sexes involved in politics and looking at the prospects of running for office. And number four, it's a patriotic duty of women to help run this country. They represent more than one half of the population. They own more than one half of the wealth. And they got more than one half of the brains. And furthermore, my wife and I had six under seven.
Oh, gee.
Well, we could have talked. Well, I would like to affirm all of that, and particularly a couple of things that you said. One is this whole area of women and security and sending the troops off. We have worked a great deal, and my book has just been reissued, Why Women Can and Must Help Run the World, with the last a kind of epilogue that talks about women in time of war, because war has changed enormously. We haven't fought a war that we knew how to fight in 30 years except for that brief Gulf War, because conflicts are coming up across states, not, you know, one state to another, but in regions of the world like we're seeing in Darfur and the Congo and other places. And therefore, they come up, though, over the issues that women have championed as a rule, and that is over education and employment and the environment, the human security issues. So we really need new approaches. We need diplomacy. We need a new kind of foreign policy. And even West Point trains people differently now. They train them in relational work and social studies and cultural studies because we can't solve conflict in other ways. So we really do need more women at this time. And yes, they would not send people, I think, quite as easily. Although we've had some women who did that, but they were kind of first women who had to be man enough for the job. Mm-hmm. And second, he's absolutely right about getting this done in high school. We need young people, men and women, and particularly women. Women stop leading after high school. They stop leading in college. So we need to really do some work on democracy, leadership, and politics in our high schools.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk just a little bit about the presidential race. What do you make of the fact that it would appear that gender is playing a role in support for Senator Clinton, and that race is playing a role in support for Senator Obama. Is that okay? Is that disturbing to you in any way?
Well, I think what's disturbing is not the role that gender and race are playing in terms of who and how we choose to allocate our support, but the fact that in our country we are now having conversations about gender and race in a way that is not productive, because to have it individually among between candidates who are very fine candidates is not the way to have this conversation. But where what's happening that's very different is really in Iowa, women's support, it was women's, to a great extent, the women's vote that supported Obama, particularly young women. And Hillary Clinton came out without having the women's vote in Iowa. She recaptured the women's vote in New Hampshire, and yet, and also a great many African Americans have are pretty split between Clinton and Obama. So there is race and gender. We can't act like it's not there.
Right.
You know, it is there. And, you know, but I think Americans, the first thing is party trumps everything, okay? Party trumps race, gender, et cetera. But the second thing is that what will really trump things, after all, I think, in this election, is who people feel can turn this country around, because there is a great dissatisfaction with where we are in our economic and our foreign policy in this country. So in the long run, I trust that that's going to triumph.
What happened to the Republicans this go around? There really is a stark difference when you look at the debates, and heavens knows we've watched so many of them. They are all white males, and there are a number of Republican women, probably not a number of color, but there are some. There are certainly women who are Republicans who are have risen to the top of political leadership. Why haven't they broken into the race for the presidency?
Well, one of the things that we are working very hard on and do very well is we actually train women across party and we train women across race. And, for instance, 38% of the women who came to our training in Wisconsin were African-American, and 10% were Hmong, and 12% were Latinas.
Great.
2%
Great.
American. I mean, we have a really, really different way that we are recruiting people, you know, to really enter politics right now, and so we have to start by changing the pipeline that's actually entering the system, so that again we have enough diversity where we have some choices. And once people get in, if there are enough people like them, we really lose that whole focus on, you know, on race and gender.
We have an email, Kelly from West Bend. Throughout my career, I've found that professional women are very hard on other professional women, especially as they climb the corporate ladder. Would you agree with this, and why do you think this occurs?
Well, I'm really glad you called in, because I have the White House Project actually has a corporate council. Excuse me. And in that corporate council, there are 24 companies. And what we're working on is how women can work together across those companies to get more women into the leadership of companies. I think partially because, again, the pipeline to power in corporate America is every bit as narrow as in political America. You have about the same number of CEOs as you have governors in this country of Fortune 500 companies, 9. You know, you don't have a lot of role models to look at.
Right.
The other thing is, what happens when women do have children and there are not support systems is if there are not a lot of women who can opt out. Because women are now, you know, equally responsible in so many families, the majority of families, for the income.
Mm-hmm.
But they are opting out of some of the positions that take more time and are the line positions that lead to power. But what we haven't developed is, I think, in the companies, enough of an opportunity for women to actually support each other. There's Best Buy, by the way, is an interesting company. They have started something in their company that breaks women up into kind of groups where they actually intentionally help each other move along.
Hmm.
And I'm looking at that because I think it takes real intentionality. But the other part is, it is just very hard to put in the kind of 24/7 hours, again, when you have other responsibilities and get to the top of these companies. And so people start to, the few people that get there, I think, start to take each other out every
right.
now and then.
And then we have the whole issue of money, right, Marie? So if you don't have women in some of those high-power jobs making a lot of money, if you have childcare responsibilities as well, if you happen to be not very wealthy, or if you happen to be poor, you're pretty much out of the game, right? Because it costs a ton to run for office.
It costs a great deal. Well, it costs money to run for office. We can train women on how to raise money, and we did. When we did our Wisconsin training this year, women were, I think, surprised at when they get into the room, finding out, at least when they start to do the local work, that they can build support, that you have a bigger network of friends, and that, you know, a lot of the women who run for office are women who've been organizing, you know, marches or organizing, you know, legislative issues for years. They've gotten people to give time. And so when they start to understand that giving money, a lot of people would rather give you money to run than give you time, then they actually realize they can raise money. But then the higher up you get, the harder it is to have access to the big money right. that it takes to run.
We go next to Sarah. Hi, Sarah, from where are you from? St. Mary Point?
St. Mary's Point, yes.
In Minnesota?
That's right.
All right. Thanks, Sarah.
That's right. Well, thank you for letting me participate in this conversation. Such an important one. I look at things a little differently because I'm 65, just turned, and I know that right now I'm working on one of the campaigns, and I actually do all my telephone calling from home because there's a certain age you get to where you don't want to go to the telephone banks. You don't want to participate in all the meetings because you've done that for so many years. So what do you suggest for women 65 and older? You know, because a lot of them, when I've been doing my calling, you know, they're there, they're undecided, they're, you know, they're really not moving very much. What do you suggest for us older ladies?
Well, wait, what do I suggest for you to do in politics, or what do I suggest for you to
be leaders?
To be leaders?
To continue to be leaders. I mean,
yeah.
I know we do it.
Well, I actually have to say that I'm 67, and I started a new organization when I was 62, I guess, or 60, because I really feel real dedicated to it. I know it can be done. But I'm very interested in having – there are many ways people can lead in their communities. I mean – my gosh, you look around and you figure out, you know, you get together with a group of friends who are 65 and you say, what would you like to take on? You know, there are things that you can change in your community from home. There are ways that you can organize people to vote or to get to the polls and influence an election. But what I'm also interested in is we need seasoned people to actually be a part of, again, county commissions, school boards,
sure,
serve on these committees that are appointed by the legislature, boards and commissions. I mean, these things are places where wisdom, experience, calmness, intensity, I mean, you know, really count. And we're living longer. So it's a good time, actually, to take on a political job or just a job that a group of women create. A group of women in one of the states a couple of years ago actually decided to change their city council, and they didn't run, but they got together and figured out who they wanted to run. They went and asked them to run. They baked, you know, they made dinners for them, et cetera, and they turned their city council over. So there are all kind of ways to make a difference.
And you have to, and we're not at a stage yet. You've made reference to the fact that a woman John McCain's age would have a hard time running for president. So that's maybe another goal. But he's what, 70 something, and he's running for president.
Yeah,
so Sarah, you're young. You're young.
Actually, 65. I mean, I hate to say something like this, but 65 is kind of the new 50. the way we're living.
But I still think the comfort zone starts to settle in, and so then you say, okay, how do we decide that we're going to now give, you know, four nights a week, 4 days a week, to then do again what we did when we were younger.
Well, I'm not saying that everybody has to give that. I agree with you. I mean, there's a time when you get to rest, but you're doing things from home. So much organizing now, so much work is done on the computer. I mean, so much of what needs to be done in terms of motivating people now happens in people's homes. They never have to budge to make a difference. They have, you know, meetings together online. I mean, I don't think it's the same thing, but I would still, you know, for those people who don't mind going out, you know, at least a night a week to participate in something, I think it's really important to have people who are our age in the system. We're old enough to kind of know what to do.
Thank you, Sarah, for your call. We have lines open if you'd like to join our conversation. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Marie Wilson, founder of the White House Project, is our guest. She is also the author of Closing the Leadership Gap, Why Women Can and Must Help Run the World. She has been an advocate of women's issues for many decades now, co-creator of Take Our Daughters and Sons to Work Day. She founded the White House Project in 98 in recognition of a need to build a truly representative democracy, one in which women lead alongside men in all spheres. They're doing a lot of outreach to young women through political leadership training, Go Vote initiatives. They do a lot of research on women's political participation, look at analyses of women's presence on the influential Sunday political talk shows, and more. So we're welcoming your calls on this and taking your emails as well. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we'll be talking about the safety of the food that we eat every day and why we become more concerned about this and what's happened with nationwide recalls of tainted products during the last year and a half. How do we regulate this and why it is that contaminations are showing up in foods that never before have been associated with poisoning. All right, let's go back to phone calls for Marie. 800-486-8655 is the number. Steve is next from Houston, Texas. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning, Marie.
Good morning.
This is great. I wholeheartedly support you as a conservative. I believe deeply that we need women in the highest ranks of leadership in this country. We need to bring an end to the culture of war that we've sunk ourselves into. But my wife supports as well. She works with the Women's Federation for World Peace, which is probably working with a lot of goals similar to yours. But I have an issue I'd like to get your perspective on and I guess make an appeal, and that is, as a father of two sons, as a person who was active in Wisconsin when I lived there, in my community and in coaching sports, youth sports, boys soccer team specifically for 6 years, and what I've witnessed is, in what has become common knowledge, is the collapse of the male culture in America. You know, in schools, in universities, you're not going to have too much trouble finding leadership because in some schools, my understanding is the girls outnumber the boys 2-1. And we have a falling out of boys in schools. Here in Houston, it's specifically pronounced in some in the ethnic community. And that's one aspect. And the next aspect maybe can be addressed, you know, in the larger political realm is the Hollywood culture, which does two things, which trashes boys. It really, I'm sorry to say, but it feminizes boyhood. It emaciates boys, and it shows women to be basically glorified prostitutes. I mean, like that, but I think you'd agree with me.
All right, Maria, response.
Well, I think there are two things. One is I actually added boys, and I didn't just add boys. We did a whole program when we had Take Our Daughters to Work at the very, well, from the beginning, we were concerned about boys. Let's put it that way. I have three sons and two daughters. I do feel that it's important to look at what's happening with the lives of boys across this country, because actually girls are not going to make progress if boys aren't making progress. A lot of what's happened, though, in my opinion, is not that the movies are, where I would differ with your caller, is I think the movies, while they have sexualized women, have not feminized men, but have made them into kind of super masculinized beings that that are not great role models. And what I would say to him is that we need fathers really, really much more engaged with their sons. I talk to women all over America who are working so hard to make sure that their sons get the attention, the right kind of attention. But we don't have a real deep culture, not of manhood, but of fatherhood in America. And that, I think, is a real issue. One of the things I'm most delighted about is that my oldest son is actually the father and mother in his family. His wife is a doctor, and he's a very good parent. And I think when kids see men parenting, that changes who they are. We've disconnected men from a lot of what it's important about being a father. So I'm very much interested in the whole issue of what it allowing men to really be fathers.
An email, Jean from Grant County. I've been thinking that what we need is to restructure our system to have 50% representation by women, period. And the key is that women would not compete against men, but against each other, and men would compete against men for office. This would enable women to be women and bring all our strengths to governing without compromise.
Okay, tell her to tell me how to do it. It's a good plan.
You like that plan, huh?
Yeah. I forgot to say something to the woman who is 65. There's a woman named Val Phillips that I'm sure you know.
Oh, I know her well, sure.
Beg your pardon?
Mm-hmm.
And who
we know her
was
well,
the first African-American woman to be, I think it was Secretary of State,
mm-hmm.
and who is incredible. And she is, I don't know how old this woman is, but she participated in our training in Wisconsin. I still remember she walked in to talk and to move the women who attended, and she had on these wonderful black leather pants. And I thought, God, make me like that. But, you know, 65 is nothing. I think I'm working with a woman in Atlanta, Georgia, who went back to law school when she was 60. So I just want to remind people in their own states, they have historical women who are leading in their 80s and 90s. So, you know, get with it.
Yeah. Thanks, Steve, for your call. Margo is next from Platteville. Hi, Margo.
Hi.
Hi.
I thought this might be interesting. It's not to do with politics, but the country of Norway made a law that all corporations, and they're much more tightly controlled in Norway than in the United States, must have 43% women on their board.
Right.
I think, you can go ahead and talk about it, but I thought it was incredible. But the most wonderful part of this article, believe it or not, these women who are on these boards are actually helping the corporations grow. Their minds are thinking differently than men, and it's helping a lot.
I'm so glad you said that. Part of what the White House Project does that's very different is we work across sector because we feel like having more women in politics helps women in business and vice versa. Norway passed a few years ago, I think it was about 4 years ago, a law that the publicly traded companies of Norway had to have 40% women on their boards. And it was so interesting. The company said, we won't ever be able to find them. It's terrible. But, of course, they said, and if you don't get that done in a certain number of years, I think it gave them a couple of years, then there will be sanctions. Well, there's nothing like putting teeth into something to really make it work. And they are putting the women on their boards. They have found them miraculously. And as she said, just as in this country, it's been proved that, or it's not been proved, it is being studied and it looks promising, that the more women you have on the board, the better off your company is, just for the reason she said, because we need different perspectives at the table. And women bring different perspectives. As a matter of fact, there's a lot of new brain research out that's just confirming that there's real synergy in the way men think and the way women think. And so, therefore, you know, we need all our resources, and companies are in trouble. They need women on the board. Only 15% of the board's max are women, and it's much lower in most places.
So if our minds think differently, what do women bring to the table that, if they're not there, is not addressed?
Well, it's interesting. We can talk about the fact, of course, that because of experiences, women bring something different to the table. We know that. And when there are more women in the state legislature, you get more family-friendly policies. Mm-hmm. You get different meetings where people, you know, actually get to talk and you get people brought into the process. But in terms of the brain, what's interesting is that when there is an issue, men actually tackle it differently. By and large, you know, none of this is every woman and every man. But
right.
By and large, the people who are studying brains are showing that women have a propensity in their brains to, when there's an issue, it kind of goes circular. It looks at it from every angle, and then it makes a kind of decision. Whereas men have a kind of act-react mechanism. And if you are an astronaut in the sky waiting, and something happens above, you want all that stuff going on the ground. You want somebody who's examining the issue from every angle, and you want somebody who can act when it's time. And that's a dramatic instance. But frankly, that kind of analysis of a problem, that kind of relational thinking, too, is what women are bringing. And different thinking. Women are in charge of the innovation efforts in 8 of the 10 largest companies in America because, again, of thinking outside the box and having to do this kind of different go-round when they go to attack a problem.
We go to Roman from Wausau next. Hi, Roman.
Hi, good morning. My comment might have been more appropriate on your previous program earlier, but I guess I wouldn't vote for a woman president because I deal daily in my work with folks from the Middle Eastern countries, and I don't think they give women the same respect, even though a woman might be vastly more capable than a man. And for that reason, I think I would not vote for Hillary Clinton as president. But that would be my thought on it.
Well, I see your thinking, and I would have maybe thought that years ago. But two things have certainly changed my mind. One is, of course, I interviewed Secretary of State Madeleine Albright right after she had stepped down, from being the Secretary of State, and I said, "How was it for you with men in the Middle Eastern countries and the more difficult, countries that have less respect for women? How were you treated?" And she said, "Quite frankly, I was treated well in those countries because they respected me as the representative of the United States. It's men in my country that I've not been treated well by." And so I tell your guest that, but I also tell him that right now, again, we're in a place where we need really good diplomats. And by and large, where women are trusted and where they are strong is in diplomatic leadership, because things are not being solved unless people can really sit down, pay attention to the culture, analyze the problem. And that's where women bring some strengths to the table that really augment men's strengths in the Middle East and in war. As a matter of fact, the people who are doing best over to solve things between Israel and Palestine are women at this very moment.
Thank you very much, Roman, for your call. Doug from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Doug.
Hi. Great point about the Middle East. I find it interesting that Pakistan has had a woman leader and we haven't. But my point is this. I'll try to be succinct. It seems as if to me, I'm a huge anti-war activist, and it seems to me that Hillary Clinton, for example, talks as if she's very, very pro-intervention. And I was wondering, were you doing handsprings when, like, Kay Bailey Hutchinson was elected, or if Camille Paglia would run for office, or Margaret Thatcher, for example, how she conducted her foreign policy? I mean, I'd rather see women who actually stand up for, quote-unquote, women's issues, like Naomi Klein or somebody from that vein, mm-hmm. Cynthia McKinney, for example. I have so much respect for them. My question is, do you hold women to a standard where they should be supporting, quote-unquote, women's issues?
Well, I couldn't agree more with you about having women in power who bring themselves to the table. So they bring a rich experience with relational thinking, with women's issues, with peace issues. Because we just had, the largest summit that's ever been held in this country with two partners, the White House Project, the Council of Women World Leaders, and Women's Intercultural Leadership Forum, two groups headed by Mary Robinson. And we brought 60 women in to look at how we shift the paradigm of security. The issues that you're talking about have to do with women in other countries who have been first. And those first and only women have had to prove they're man enough for the job. And when you only have one woman running, she is really in a problem area because numbers matter, as I said earlier. One woman has to prove she's tough at the same time that she's caring, that she cares about women, but she doesn't dismiss men. I mean, that's why we need two or three women running, because then men and women could really represent all those different areas. And peace building is one of the most important aspects that we're looking at. what you want is what we'll get when we have three or four women running for the presidency and three or four women running for congressional offices, just like we have men. Because, again, then it will be more normal and it won't be a big deal if you are you can support women's issues without somebody saying, well, you're just running because you're a woman and you're just running to support women's issues. So numbers really matter. But at the same time, we really have a lot of women leaders in this country, particularly the governors, who are representing, I think, women's issues extraordinarily well and doing well by men, too. And I think there's probably a lot of different opinion about whether Senator Clinton herself does that, but there are people that feel she does and people like yourself who feel she doesn't. But we're not going to have perfection, but we can do better when we have more people, so the pressure's not on that one woman.
Yeah. Before we have to say goodbye to you, Marie, is there a website in case people want more information about the White House Project?
Well, I hope you'll go to www.thewhitehouseproject.org because you can find out about the Wisconsin trainings, the Minnesota trainings, and
great,
what we're doing around the country.
Thewhitehouseproject.org.
Yes.
All right. Thanks, Marie. Great hour. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to talk to so many men.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks. Marie Wilson, founder and president of the White House Project, author of Closing the Leadership Gap, Why Women Can and Must Help Run the World. It's thewhitehouseproject.org if you want more information about their training sessions and all the work that they're doing in the Midwest and beyond. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production in our Milwaukee studios, and thanks everybody for all of your calls. News is ahead from National Public Radio. We'll return with more Tuesday Conversation here on the Ideas Network.